Hello, and welcome to episode 119 of the Crate and Crowbar podcast. It is the 17th of November. I am Tom Francis. Here with me today are...
Marsh Davis!
And...
Tom Senior.
My pointing was weak there. We don't have any real news from the outside world this week, but it is Games Journalist Christmas, which we haven't talked about, which is the IGF judging period, where I guess it's Game Developer Christmas as well, because, you know... the judges of the IGF are a huge pool of hundreds and hundreds of journalists and developers and people related to games. And because they get like 800 entries, they would just want as many judges who know something as possible. And then they get them all to give them all access to all these games in this kind of sophisticated back end thing so they can get as many opinions on them as possible. And so basically, you have to rate some games that you're assigned to judge, and then you can also rate the other ones and go around grabbing them. I actually haven't rated my minimum number of games yet.
That's three games, Tom.
I know.
That is lame.
I played the first one and it was crap. I played the second one and it was crap. And I played the third one and it was really good, so I carried on playing it.
Oh, I see.
That's the story so far. And how about you guys? Have you finished your judging?
I've done my obligatory three. I have to say, it's been a bit of a disappointment this year, in as much as there are really strong games in the running for it. But I've played all the good ones already. Like in previous years, it was always kind of the reason it's Christmas is because you're opening things and you don't know what's inside them and they're exciting and fun. Well, I know all the games that are likely to win it this year. I've played them all. And so it's kind of a known quantity. And the ones that so far that I've stumbled across haven't really been all that exciting. But I don't know. What do you think? Is it a good year for indie games in that case?
I've not really delved into it. Hasn't closed, has it? The deadline for...
No.
No, oh, thank goodness
for
that.
No, I've been away for a lot of last week, so I've not had the chance to properly get stuck into it. Though I still have that kid on Christmas morning feeling of wading into it. Like the fact that there is this enormous back end and you could just download stuff almost at will as long as you rate a lot of them is amazing. such a good distribution tool. Like, it should almost exist independently of the IGF.
Yeah, I always say that the comments threads on there of just what the judges say about the games are just kind of fascinating in itself. It just feels like a forum that I go to hang out in now just to see what people are saying about often games that I do know. One kind of surprise, although it makes sense, is that Mushroom 11 isn't in there. And I was thinking... that was going to be, you know, a shoe-in to at least be nominated for something and possibly even win one of the categories. And I was trying to think, why isn't it in there? And then I realized, oh, because it was a finalist in a previous year. If you're a finalist once, you can't enter again.
Yeah, I always think it's a big mistake for games to enter too early in their life.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of entries there were inexplicable to me because there is an entrance fee, right?
Yes.
It's kind of weird to see games in there which are obviously either really, really early or kind of shitty. And you think, surely you knew this was either really, really early or kind of shitty.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, in the best possible world, it would have been a mediocre and not terribly ambitious puzzle or something like that. And you think, why did you spend... So is there some kind of other cachet or advantage, do you think, to entering the IGF, even if you know you're not in for a chance to do well at all?
I mean, the year that I entered Gunpoint, I was doing it mainly for the feedback. I wanted to know, because I'd had lots of feedback from just testers and friends, but I wanted it to be judged more harshly. I wanted to know, like, what are critics and other developers who don't know me think of this?
You don't get feedback this year, though.
Well, yeah, so you don't get any feedback at all this year, and even the year I did it, you don't get the feedback till after the IGF itself happens, like the next year. So it's like nine months or something. The game was done and released by the time I got any feedback.
And here's all the mistakes you could have avoided.
So it was utterly useless from that perspective. And yeah, now they've abandoned that angle of it at all, which I think is actually a little bit of a mistake.
Did they give a reason for getting rid of that stuff?
They said that it wasn't, that they'd had feedback on the feedback that it wasn't good quality feedback, which I'm sure is just a lot of, you know, no one likes to get feedback on. It's always upsetting. And that they seem to say that it was to do with making it easier for the judges, sort of. I think because on the back end you get like five different categories to fill out in terms of like, what do you want to say to the developer, what do you want to say to the jury, who are the smaller panel who actually decide the winners, and what do you want to say to the other judges, and also here's the technical bit where you can ask questions about that. And so now one of those fields is gone, but it kind of seems like telling the developer why, like I say, the reason I entered the IGF the year that I did was I specifically wanted that question answered of why isn't this IGF worthy if it's not? Hmm. It didn't work out for the timing reasons. I think back to the question of like, is it ever worth entering before your thing is properly finished? The year that I entered was the year they introduced the rule that if you become a finalist, you can't enter again. And so I knew that going in and I still did it. And it might still have been the right thing to do because we did get picked as a finalist. And I think at that time, it was just really good to have that kind of prestige and just be able to kind of, I didn't sort of wave it around when I'm talking to the press, but I think a lot of people just have heard of it now because it's in the IGF or it kind of got recognition. That said, I'm not entering heat signature till it's done.
Right.
Because...
it's going to presumably release next year, right, heat signature?
Who knows?
Well, what I mean is, are you going to get it done, then enter it in the IGF, then release? Or are you going to get it done, release, then enter into the IGF?
Probably the latter. I certainly wouldn't hold it back for that.
Right.
I don't think it really matters that much to the judging process whether it's out or not. It's sort of, you know, sometimes there's a bit more of a buzz about a thing that's kind of new.
Yeah, but by the time, I don't know, I'm like, getting an IGF norm is probably good for your sales in a, later on, isn't it? I mean, if you haven't been released, I can't imagine that if, for example, what's the game by the guy by the Stanley Parable?
Beginner's Guide.
The Beginner's Guide. If the Beginner's Guide scoops an award, which I think it probably deserves to, then it's not going to affect sales when the award is announced next year.
It might.
Do you think?
It gives press a reason to cover it.
I mean, that one's already been a big hit, so and it already had a lot of publicity just from being by him and, you know, causing a stir. So it's a question of, like, what was the really cool discovery last year? The game where you fly around. Oh, Outer Wilds. Yeah. Game where you fly around, you know. that one... that was out in a public way, but something like that where no one had heard of it. I think if it was already available to buy and finished, then it getting all that buzz then and there would be really useful for it. But anyway, have you guys played anything good from it?
I played, I have. The one game that I've discovered, which I think, which I hadn't heard of before, which I think is really good, is Darknet. Which is designed to be a VR experience, but it works perfectly fine without VR. And it's a hacking game, except unlike all other hacking games, it's not boring as fuck because it doesn't make you do any actual hacking or coding. Yes! It's a hacking game designed for idiots like me. And it's just a really interesting puzzle game with a kind of cyberpunk hacking theme, I guess. So... it's going to be hard to explain because it's obviously abstract. So, yeah.
It's first person, isn't it? In a weird way.
It is first person. You're kind of embedded in this abstract other world of spheres, basically. And when you start a game, you're given a list of, you can kind of look around 360 degrees and all these kind of floating tablets telling you the day's news. And there's some kind of weird cryptography thing, which is presumably relevant later in the game that I haven't discovered yet. And there's a list of kind of, there's a kind of node you click and you go into this other world which has all these floating spheres which represent the different kind of networks and missions you have, or kind of commissions rather, to hack different networks. And each of them has a different difficulty rating and a time in which you're meant to complete it. And by completing it, I mean you have to get into a network and steal the target data. So when you click on one of these missions, you go into this sphere made out of other spheres, all of which are connected by wires or kind of streams of data. It's really quite beautiful to look at, I think. And each of these spheres, or I shall call them nodes from now on, represents a kind of a hackable unit of data. But all these hackable units of data aren't necessarily kind of equal. Some of them will have properties, such as some of them be high value, so you get money per hack. And some of them will be more money, and the money will come relevant later. And some of them will have properties like being able to cast shields on surrounding nodes or unleash programs which will go to nodes that you've already captured, already hacked, I should say, and captured, and take them back. And when you hack a node, it becomes purple rather than yellow or blue, which is the kind of the unhacked nodes. And you can obviously get money for that, and also you have a number of programs that you can buy with the funds that you accrue while hacking different nodes within a single network. You can spend that money on things like viruses, which I'll explain later, and there's a worm, which I don't really understand how it works, but it seems to not capture nodes automatically, but it kind of disables their effect on the surrounding nodes. And also there's another thing which automatically captures all unprotected nodes.
Yeah, that thing's great.
Yeah, it's super useful early on because you get large swathes of yellow nodes, which are basically kind of naked, unprotected nodes that you could easily hack. But as soon as they're shielded by surrounding nodes, that stops the kind of spread of your whatever program it is. I can't remember the term they use for it. It's like,
I can't remember either.
You know, it spreads anyway. So you plant it in a hacked node and it kind of blah, 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 spreads out from that and into the kind of the surrounding data. And so you have to be quite tactical about it because you obviously got one particular node which contains the target data, but it's usually really high value and well protected. So it's got lots of firewalls around it, which you can nullify by hacking and capturing surrounding nodes. And every time you capture a node, the nodes that are connected to it lose one degree of firewall safety. And so you're planning your route through this thing, hacking and breaking down kind of the shielding so that you can drop these things, which will then automatically capture large swathes of it, which will give you a windfall, which you can spend on other stuff. But each time you buy a program, it doubles the cost of subsequent purchases.
Right.
So you really need, you can totally fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And it's so annoying when you do that. There's a particular program which allows you just to automatically take down firewalls. Just you kind of click on a node that you want to deplete the firewalls of, and it would bloop, 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 take one down at a time. And I was being too greedy. I had a really short amount of time for this hack, 20 minutes or something. These kind of each individual hack is actually quite a lengthy game session by the standards of these sort of games. And so 20 minutes was pretty tight. And so I got greedy. I thought, I know, I'm not going to bother trying to accrue a large amount of wealth that I can then spend buying viruses. I'm just going to buy these things, hammer down this thing's defenses, and then go for it. And in the end, I didn't have enough resources to throw at the hack once I'd taken down its firewalls. And then because I'd spent all my money, I didn't have enough money to take down the other defenses in the surrounding network, which would then got me more money back that I could spend it, and I ran out of time, and then I was very upset. But that's just the kind of metagame. The actual kind of level of puzzling occurs within a single attempt to capture one of these nodes. So when you click on a node, you go into this other view, it kind of zooms down into this sphere, and this sphere is then, on what's kind of the inner surface of the sphere is represented this array of hexes. And some of the hexes, it's kind of just a big kind of wibbly-wobbly grid pattern, a bit like a honeycomb, and some of them, you know, it's oddly shaped and there are holes in it and stuff. And some of the hexes are lit up, I think in blue. I've actually completely forgotten what color they are now. Maybe it's yellow. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. And at the center of this honeycomb is a kind of sphere, which is your kind of actual target. And what you do is with the viruses that you've bought, which are a particular subsection of the programs that you can buy, you can click on one of the lit honeycomb cells and then click on the sphere. And what happens is that you take over that honeycomb cell, and from the center of that honeycomb cell, each surrounding cell then gets captured. So it happens, you know, spreads out, your capture spreads out across this honeycomb. And if your kind of spreading purple hack reaches the sphere, then you've captured it. But if that spreading purple hack hits another cell, which was lit up, but you haven't captured, then it causes a subsequent explosion of kind of the home system's kind of whatever repellent
antivirus
program. Yeah, antivirus. And it spreads out through your kind of purple corruption and destroys it. So you kind of, it's a bit like, I mean, we were talking about Every Extend Extra for some reason in a previous podcast, but it is also a bit like that, where you're kind of setting off these chains of explosions. And if you have more viruses, more strategies are open to you. So you can kind of click on several of these lit nodes, take them over, And so, presumably, your spreading corruption will not then be impeded by one of their explosions because their explosion becomes part of your purple.
Yeah.
Or you can detonate them prematurely to wipe them out and then drop other viruses to kind of, you know, to spread unimpeded towards your eventual goal.
It's a weird thing. Took me a long time to figure out. I played it at Indiecade, and I did play in VR. I can't really speak to how it compares to non-VR because I haven't tried that, but didn't seem to desperately need it. But yeah, it took me a long time to figure it out. I think I'd missed the tutorial or something, and I was just dumped straight into that mode. And every time, it's one of those things that might just be me, but I couldn't get it by experimentation. I had to have it explained to me. I tried like 7 or 8 times just kind of planting them and seeing what happened, and I couldn't spot a pattern in what was happening, or I didn't even know what I was trying to achieve.
Because it has a really good tutorial. In that, it is barely a tutorial. Basically, a voice just says, like, maybe a sentence of 5 or 6 words before each thing, and it's so clear. Like, it's weird that explaining it now is really hard because I'm an idiot, but the way that it's presented in the game is just so transparent, and it's weird. You only need like somebody to say a single sentence, and suddenly it becomes right, okay, I get that completely. But it complicates it, that virus capture gameplay, by adding extra elements as you go through. So there are honeycomb cells which don't wipe out your virus, but they just detonate part of the honeycomb structure itself and kind of cut it off, which can be useful or terrible depending on what your plan is. And there's other ones which can create these kind of fault lines which instantaneously fill with your virus. But that can be also good or bad, because it can either hasten your virus's spread towards the sphere at the center, or it can hasten it towards things that will detonate it and wipe out your intended corruption plan. But it's really impressive, and I've got to a stage in it now where I think maybe it's a bit kind of flabby in the mid game. There's stuff that seems to be trailed later on. Like there's unlockable skills that you can spend your dollars on. I can't remember. It's like BTM or something. I'm not quite sure what the currency is. But one of them seems to imply that you get some extra view mode into the source code of the level or something. I'm not quite sure what that means. It's probably not really the source code of the level, but it's, and there's also this, if you spin round on certain levels, there are these number grids behind you, and you can kind of click on them and numbers light up. I have no idea what they do.
That's number wang.
Yeah. So there's obviously something interesting going on later, but right now, I'm stuck in this bit where it's escalating the difficulty level. But actually, what that means is that there are just fewer strategic options open to me, which feels more like a contraction of the game rather than an expansion of it. And it's getting a slightly bit grindy. Like, I'm just going to have to fucking plug away at it until I earn enough money to unlock whatever these new gameplay elements are. So,
I think it's been in the IGF before, because I remember somebody saying that it was like the first great VR game, that it was something that felt really built for VR. Like I say, I didn't totally feel that way about it, but
it would be cool in VR if you're poking these things, I suppose, with your hands, your real hands.
Yeah, but so that's not how did I play it? I think I just had a conventional controller. I can't remember what
it was. It comes up with a gamepad at the beginning of the game, but weirdly the gamepad doesn't work with the version I've got, so I've been using mouse and keyboard, and that worked, just mouse actually.
Yeah, I didn't have like a sort of, you know, physically manifested hand in the game world or anything. But yeah, that makes me wonder about its chances in the IGF. I suppose it might just be, you know, more people have access to it. I feel like pitching it as a VR thing might be maybe a mistake, in that then everyone who doesn't have VR is probably never going to try it unless they hear this podcast.
They should. Well, I'll put a note for the judges saying you should play this even if you don't have VR.
Yeah. The good one of my three was Glitch Space, which I'm afraid is a programming game.
No!
Yet another programming game. This is one that, there was a video of it a long time ago that got a lot of attention, because at that time, programming games hadn't been done to death. But playing it now, it's still got a lot of things going on that, it was still kind of refreshing, because it, it's a first-person game with big white levels, and in those levels you'll come to like a gap, and there'll be a big red floor in front of you, and then a gap after that, and you can't reach the other side. And then if you right-click on the red bit, that's a programmable block, and you will edit its code. And its code is presented as a flowchart, and there will be a block in the flowchart. There'll be a kind of a square representing the object itself, and then another box representing like transform, which means move, and then another one representing like the y-axis, and then another one representing like 10. And so it's, you don't write any code. It's all done by visually dragging things around. But it doesn't have any text tutorial as far as I can remember. It labels these things and it tells you what they are. But it teaches you just by being incredibly restrictive about what it lets you edit and what it doesn't. So the first time you find it, all of that will be rigged up for you. And all there is just the number one is not connected to the vector one. And so you see, you might not understand quite what's going on, but what's the code is basically saying, you know, it's ready for to move this thing along the y-axis by a certain amount, but the amount itself is not plugged into the equation. So you just drag a line and connect it in, and then suddenly the panel moves and bridges the gap and you walk across it. And then later on, and then it's sort of slow, like the next one will be almost exactly the same thing, but now you get to edit the vector as well. So you get to say, I want it to move in the y-axis instead of the z-axis or whatever. And as you're editing, there's a little guide on screen as to how y, z, and x correlate to the directions you're looking in and stuff. And then later on, you can kind of, you get conditional things. So instead of doing all this stuff to the object, which is, you know, the actual thing you're editing, you can do it to anything that collides with this object. So anything that collides with this object will be propelled by this force in this direction. And then you've made yourself a jump pad. And one of the puzzles is just there's a pad that you can program like a jump pad. And the objective, or sorry, the next bit of the level that you can see is just this floating island that's just like 20 kilometers up and slightly to the right and a little bit ahead. And so you're like, okay, what are the values of X, Y, and Z that are going to catapult me up there? So it's quite, it is still a very technical game because it's symbols and, you know, sort of logical links, but they correspond to, you know, bouncing around a world in quite a fun way. And at first I was annoyed that it would, at how restrictive it was being in terms of like, you can only edit this box this time, and this time you can only edit this box. And so it feels very much like solving puzzles rather than creating anything. But then after a while I kind of, you know, I come to the third puzzle and realize, actually, I've forgotten what you said last time. And so it's good that you're not letting me edit this, because I can't remember how you hook these things up. Like, what kind of connection goes into this box? And yeah, by the end of, I haven't completed it, but I've probably played like an hour or more. And I sort of came to appreciate the way it teaches you things. I think it's actually pretty good. By the time you get some freedom, you really know what you're doing, and you can really basically write code, but with these blocks. I don't totally know if I'm going to vote for it in anything, because the trouble is, it's like, you can't really call it innovative, because there are so many other games teaching this kind of stuff just in slightly different ways. I think maybe for design, because it is mostly because of the way it teaches you stuff is actually really effective. But yeah, it's very easy to make like a very good, competent game that is not worthy of any IGF category.
Yeah.
The IGF
yeah.
categories are for standing out in one particular way that, you know, other games don't. Is that all our IGF?
It's all I want to talk about from the IGF.
For now.
For now. What have you guys been playing?
I've been playing two massively multiplayer online role-playing games, if you remember those, gentlemen, from 2 years ago.
I almost don't.
Yeah, that's the thing. They seem... It's easy to forget that millions and millions of people are still playing them, and it's easy to forget how big they were just a few years ago and how they seem to have dwindled so like very fast in the last couple of years. But I've been playing Star Wars The Old Republic. And Guild Wars 2's expansion, Heart of Thorns. And they're both very interesting in very different ways and very contrasting ways as well. So The Old Republic has been refitted now. It's a Star Wars MMO from BioWare and EA. And it was a very, very conventional MMO when it launched, with all the kind of grind systems that you'd expect and people with exclamation marks or the equivalent, the Star Wars equivalent, which is a futuristic triangle above someone's head, which is a quest. And it would be very much this, the familiar MMO pattern of take a shopping list of these triangles and, you know, put them into a list and then We'll highlight the zones on the map where you can accomplish them by clicking on things and killing mobs. And then you'll tick them off one by one, you'll gain experience. And the big thing that it offered was that once you'd actually done a sufficient amount of that, it would let you go into your next story bit. Mm. And when you entered into the story zones, which are literally, blocked off from the rest of the world by barriers that are either green or red. And these are...
I cannot story yet.
These are the barriers of narrative that you're not allowed to go through. And certain corridors and rooms are blocked off from you based on class. So if you're a Jedi Knight as opposed to a Han Solo type kind of rogue class, you will only be allowed into certain rooms in order to experience certain bits of story.
Lame.
Yeah. And this is one of the strange things about it. Then when you actually go to those rooms, it's great because it's basically a BioWare Star Wars RPG, a lot like KOTOR. And, KOTOR is great. And there should definitely be a KOTOR 3 soon, you would hope, given that Star Wars is coming back in massively. Mm. And it would seem like a massive oversight for EA not to bankroll a new Star Wars RPG from BioWare, which they have, this growing studio just sitting there. But yeah, the only way now that you can get a KOTOR type experience that you haven't played before is to play Star Wars The Old Republic. And that's good because they completely redesigned the game to allow you to only play the single player missions without all the grind in between. Oh, wow. So they've changed it so that the experience you get from those story narrative bits inside your narrative rooms will give you enough experience to just hopefully just chain quite easily onto the next thing. So you can go from planet to planet and just experience your story, get it all done in probably like 20 or 30 hours and get a nice Star Wars game out of it.
Awesome.
Which is awesome, but it creates a very, very bizarre situation where you're going into these rooms and having conversations and dialogue trees and getting light side and dark side points from each of these kind of all the decisions you're making and killing your characters. It's all good BioWare drama. And then you go through the story door and then you're in bizarro MMO world where you're in these cavernous environments with mobs respawning everywhere. Right. And this incredibly fiddly and by now already really old-fashioned taskbar MMO combat where I my Jedi kind of consular guy who's got a double-bladed lightsaber has about 25 skills and half of them are redundant. Half of them do similar things to other skills and just shouldn't exist. They're just, this one does slightly less damage, but it might do slightly more penetration for some characters in a way that will just make no difference to combat generally. And because your companions heal you so well all the time, it's irrelevant anyway. Combat is just purely padding and it looks kind of nice, if a bit dated, but you can breeze through that stuff quite quickly, but it's almost kind of, it's insidious how being an MMO changes the way that environments are and the way that menus look and the way that everything is slightly, nothing feels, like quick, nothing feels, what's the word, immediate. None of your interactions feel immediate. They always feel like they're on a delay of some kind, whether you're attacking someone or pressing a button to talk to someone. And it's like the whole experience is weighed down by this like tumor of bad genre that's just hanging off this thing and dragging it all down. And you go to Coruscant, and Coruscant's should be an astonishing place of just high technology and traffic routes of spaceships sort of whizzing overhead. And if you're in the right place in the right hub, you can look up and see that stuff. But as soon as you walk into a building, they are just like warehouses. You're walking into a vast warehouse, and there are these kind of rebellious elements, like these kind of criminal gangs who loiter groups of three or four at very specific distance apart from each other so that they won't aggro each other or you won't aggro too many of them at the same time. And because, like, you can see them pulling the levers on this stuff because clearly they know that too many people are going through this area. They don't want people waiting for people, for those gangsters to respawn. So you get gangsters respawning on the corpses of themselves that another crew has just walked through and slain. And they'll just like loiter around on top of their own bodies.
Got a good feeling about this.
And in a game that's trying to tell a story, that's death. Yeah. It's just the, and I was thinking about I was thinking, how did I ever put up with this crap? Because I had played a lot of The Old Republic. I got up to level 50 when it was still an MMO. I think part of it was that I was playing with Chris and some other friends, and that makes a huge difference because you can kind of laugh it off. But it's the amount of kind of creative input it requires from the player to kind of delude themselves into not seeing that stuff is so huge that I'm not sure that modern players coming up who have never played that kind of MMO would put up with it or stand for it now. And I think as a genre, it's dead because of that. It's been, that level of disconnect between what you're doing and what the fantasy is just too great. And modern technology, it feels like MMOs of that ilk were designed around the enormous constraints of technology, of what internet connections were capable of doing, the interactions that internet connections were capable of sustaining. And that is such a vast limiting factor. And MMOs like Tor have kept those in by choice. Because that's the way that the genre is. And they've left them in there because that's how they think that's what people expect from an MMO. And that's very interesting when you then go on to play Guild Wars 2, which is ArenaNet's attempt to solve the MMO and try and incorporate, take into account the advanced technology and think about what if quest zones weren't just a checklist of things where you go up to exclamation marks and click on them. What if there were like dynamic zones that were constantly changing and there were two forces contesting it? And depending on when you dropped into the map, the war for that zone would be at a certain point, and that would determine the types of quests you were doing. And you would never ever have to click on an NPC to get a quest box. It would just be intuitive. You would know what you had to do by simply what the map looked like and the type of enemies that are around and what kind of bits were circled on the map and stuff like that. And they have been enormously successful in that. And they've moved further and further towards that in the updates they've done since launch in Guild Wars 2. So in the original launch of Guild Wars 2, which is free now, and it's a brilliant game and basically the best MMO. And if you want to, if you've got a group of friends, you want to do an MMO, it's beautiful and fantastic and really streamlined. And free to play Guild Wars is just superb. But in the initial release, they had these little characters with hearts above their heads. And this was their concession to the idea that players want something to latch onto. They want to go up to a kind of an equivalent of a quest giver. So you'd go up to a heart person there to say, oh, there's stuff near here that you need to do. And then you'd look at the map and you'd see that there was stuff that needed doing and you'd intuitively do it. Now with Heart of Thorns, which is the first proper expansion, they've abandoned that completely. And they've weaned players off it. Throughout their living world updates, they've kind of slowly moved players off that idea into completely dynamic zones, which are just, there are no quest givers. There are scouts you can click on and they'll say, oh, this is the political situation in this area. These are the armies that are fighting for it. This is what's happening here. If you want to go check it out, this is what's happening over there. And it's fantastic. Works really, really, really well when it works. But the big problem I have with it is that it suddenly demands that there are lots of players in an area because in Guild Wars 2's Heart of Thorns expansion, entire zones are the quest. The entire zone you're in is one big quest that is in some form of completion. And when it's not, that quest isn't active, there's very little to do in that zone. There's just a lot of enemies. So it requires a number of people to be in the zone, and then for someone to act to start the event, it'll just sometimes trigger dynamically. And it might be something as simple as there's a frog species in this jungle area, and they're being given gifts of eggs by the beetle riders, who are the sinister, never trust a beetle rider, you know. And, you know, they've got these eggs, and then they realize that, oh, they're wyvern eggs. Shit. We've just had them, we've got them in our storehouses. Our children are here, and there are wyverns hatching, and there'll be a group event where anyone nearby can flock in and just kill the wyverns. And then their tribal leader will be very, very angry. That quest will end. Everyone will get a chest. Their tribal leader will be very angry. And they're just saying out loud to people around, like, this will not stand. We need to play this trick on our attackers. We're going to do the very same thing. We're going to steal some wyvern eggs. We're going to infiltrate their camp. We're going to plant them. And then he'll run off and you'll have to escort him. And you'll see him as this kind of orange shield on the map moving around. And if you drop into the map at that point, you will see that shield and you can mouse over it and it will tell you what's going on. And you can immediately just dynamically drop into that. And as soon as you get into the zone, you start earning the experience for it. You start earning the chests and you start getting the loot and start participating. And at no point do you click on anything to say, yep, checklist, I want to do this. It's just simply playing the game and being rewarded for it. And it's beautiful. And then you'll be led to Sarah and he says, you need to go and gather the Wyvern eggs. So you do this massive jumping puzzle all the way up to this plateau, and there are just Wyverns fucking flaming it. Just there, they're so pissed off that you're there.
Understandably.
Don't want you there. It's fine. They know, like, the beetle guys came and stole their kids, and now you're here to
we need some more of your kids to get our own back on those beetles.
Basically, we don't know how to use weapons. Our only weapon available to us is your young. So, you know, that's just what's going to happen. And you have to go up there, and your objective isn't to kill the Wyverns. It's just to steal their eggs and get the flip out of there. And because there are these new glider mechanics. So you do this hopping puzzle all the way up to the top, and then you grab an egg as these Wyverns are circling and flaming, and then you jump off and activate your glider and just slowly kind of glide away down to the guy and give him the egg. And all these things are things that I've never done in an MMO before, and they feel so satisfying and so much fun because there are people around you doing it.
Is it like free gliding, like in Far Cry?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes. Yeah, so when you're,
I can't imagine anything not just so unprescriptive in a
massive multiplayer. Yeah. And this has been their kind of design philosophy all along with ArenaNet, with the Guild Wars 2, is to kind of challenge all the assumptions that people have made about that genre and the way it has to be because of technology. And they like, latency is good enough to do that now. You can, so all you have to do once you've earned your gliding wings. And they only work in this particular zone, which has been designed for it, because the zones are amazing. They're just these incredibly tall mountainous places, jungle places. And the idea of the story of, for example, the first area is that there's this forest dragon who's very bad, and so the citizens sent an air force against it, and then the trees themselves reached up and grabbed them out of the air and crushed them. And that's the state in which you enter the zone. So you look up and you see these shattered flaming wrecks crushed by trees above you, and you can climb up there, and you can, like, there are just all these levels of verticality is the buzzword for it, but that's what they've done with an MMO zone. And they facilitated it with these mushrooms that you bounce up and down, and these air drafts that will sweep you up if you're in air. And it's this stuff that just, I wish that this had been around, as Tor was launching, or before Tor's launch, back in the almost the heyday of the MMO, there's just a big kind of middle finger to the kind of rote repetition of the same things.
How does the Wyvern egg thing? I'm used to like MMO events being things that can repeat. So presumably, the Wyvern deception, the Wyvern egg Trojan horse, wouldn't really work a second time. Like, wouldn't the frog species be annoyed? But like,
this is where it breaks. It does break eventually, because these events, of course, have to repeat. But I think as a kind of creative thing to get over, to pace over as a player, it's much easier to do it with these big quests than it is for the Tor version, where it's all just so artificial all the time. You're constantly watching your...
You have to
queue up for some objectives. You have to wait for the thing that's on fire to respawn so you can put it out again. And, you know, one of the great things about Tor is that you have companions, and these are proper characters with their own arcs, and, you know, if you do lots of missions for them and make them happy, then you get more dialogue and they develop and you can, and they change. The trouble is, you just see someone running around with the same Wookiee as you because they're so developed. They can't have many of them. So everyone in your class is going to probably have the similar, like one of two or three of them. And it's just, old school MMOs confront you with that all the time. Is that kind of, you just have to almost look away or just kind of pretend it didn't happen. Whereas with Guild Wars 2, there is that, definitely that kind of contrivance of having these events go back and forth forever. But it's much, much better than anything else that's been done in the genre before.
So if you turn up a different time, and players have, you know, pulled the same Beetle Rider egg-bearing gift gambit on the Beetle Riders themselves. Do you walk around their village and the Beetle Rider says, I know what we'll do, we'll play this amazing trick.
We've got the idea for the frog people.
That might happen, actually. It seems that they always seem to reset themselves. They're always conveniently seesawing as they have to be.
And isn't that like real world violence?
The frogs and the Beetle Men, we can learn lessons on global scale. But I thought it was an interesting to play both of them. I'm still playing Tor, and it's kind of, combat aside, it's still perfectly fun MMO. Like, I get to be a Sith warrior and kind of betray my master and, you know, turn someone to the dark side and all that good stuff. And, you know, that's good. But Guild Wars 2 is where it's at. It does falter though, because without those smaller individual tasks, and there are some challenges that you can do if there aren't enough people in the zone, or if there isn't an event in flow, then there's no, the area feels dead in a way. So it's almost like a balance problem rather than a kind of design problem. Like it's almost like the server tech needs to make sure there are enough people in these zones at all times to make sure that they're actually still seesawing. But it's an interesting game. It's very good. Guild Wars 2 is excellent. What have you guys been playing?
I've been playing Fallout 4.
Hey, we've all been playing Fallout 4.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah. You not like it much?
Well, I've uninstalled it now, so that tells you. Mm. But tell me your good stories about it. So, podcast listeners don't have to listen to me whining.
But just to clear up that mystery, your uninstall was due to technical issues, right? Not so much.
A bit of both.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I couldn't really get to appreciate the game because it was just so horrendously broken for me. Hmm. But the parts of the game that weren't broken, I didn't find terribly inspiring. But I think it's partly because I've played exactly this game before now and all the previous Bethesda games, which is what we were saying in the last podcast, that there's kind of diminishing returns really from Bethesda's games. Like the value to them is partly the exploration and the wonder of that world, and I've done that in previous games, and in this one I can't really appreciate it because it's just so fucked.
I was not excited about Fallout 4. For me, Fallout is very different to the Elder Scrolls series. I would just be automatically excited about a new Elder Scrolls off the charts, and I also feel like each Elder Scrolls game has been a big jump forward and has been. Even when, like, I think Skyrim is more similar to Oblivion than any other two games in this series have been. But because the place was so different, it was automatically exciting because it was just like, oh my god, look at that, those fucking mountains, and I can go anywhere and I can do anything. Whereas Fallout 4, nothing I saw before launch made me excited in that way. It was always just like, I guess, like, I do remember really loving Fallout 3 at the time. I can't totally remember why. But I guess if it's a new one and it's like that, then I'll like it. And so I went into it pretty without my hopes particularly high, but then very quickly got completely engrossed in it and really, really enjoyed it. There's an intro bit that's very story-driven and very, like, establishes you as a particular character in this world, which I didn't like, but it's very brief, and then you're out in the wasteland. And also the next bad thing that happened was one of the things I love to do in Bethesda's games is there's always a bit where you come out of the tutorial area and then you're out in the open world and it's a big moment in all of their games. And then I always come out the gate, then I turn around and I go back in the opposite direction. And in Skyrim, that led to an amazing adventure. And actually, I wrote it up in my previous Skyrim for PC Gamer, and I reread it recently. And it was really fun to realize all the things I encounter by going in the opposite direction are like later story bits that I didn't know about because they weren't in the demo version I was playing. And in Fallout 4, I turned around and thought, oh, look at this awesome wasteland. It was way more pretty than I was expecting it. Like the footage I'd seen just seemed kind of bland. It was, you know, obviously a ruined world was always going to be bleak, but Fallout 3 had this very particular kind of bleakness. So it was very artistic and very palette chosen. That's not really a phrase, but, you know, they picked the palette carefully with a lot of thought and art style. And this time the stuff they'd shown seemed very just miscellaneous, just random blotches of color and, but actually in game, it's something to do with like the lighting, the time of day, the weather effects and stuff. I think every bit of footage I'd seen had been either a complete night or just a boring sunny day. And when you're actually playing, it's more like, you know, suddenly a mist descends on everything and everything's like sort of quietly beautiful and rays of sunshine are beaming through it. Mm. And then a radiation storm hits and everything goes green, sickly and weird. And so it has loads of style like that. But anyway, I came out of the tutorial area, turned around 180, went in the other direction and it says, you cannot go this way. I was like, oh, fuck. Mm. And then I, like, there was just like the weakest sort of plastic fence stopping me. And so I could see I couldn't go that direction. So I turned like 90 degrees and went in that direction. It says, you can't go this way. And actually, because it was so much more pretty than I expected, I had my HUD turned off. So I didn't see the message telling me I couldn't go this way. So it just felt like a massive invisible barrier. Like that plastic fence was just this huge impenetrable thing. But then eventually I looked at the map and realized it just starts you in the top left corner of the map. So it's not that it's actually being restrictive. They just start you in a place where going the opposite way is not going to work out. So what I ended up doing was hugging the north boundary of the map and just exploring in that direction, which is like going in a straight line is kind of a good way to explore because you just encounter a series of miscellaneous things. And those first moments in a Bethesda game, I think, are my favorite bits, where you just don't know what the hell to expect and you don't know how powerful anything is. And particularly because even though there are returning creatures and people from Fallout 3, their respective power levels are totally randomized. Like things that were previously nothing are now dead, absolutely deadly. Like I haven't even met one yet, but I gather rad scorpions are a huge deal in this, whereas they were just the basic enemy in,
yeah,
in Fallout
3. Bad news.
And so my first few skirmishes were like just individual raiders, just someone who's living in a little shack with a sack on his head and an attack dog that he's trained to hunt down people like me. I snuck everywhere. I was in creep mode for the entire exploration for like 4 hours or something. Just trying to take down this one guy and his dog. The first time I was sneaking up on him and he was like, I was on a cliff and he was lower down. And so I was sneaking onto the roof of his shack and trying to just get a bead on him with my weapon. I didn't really know how to, like, how accuracy worked, whether my gun would actually shoot where I was pointing or whether I had to use VATS or whatever. And I missed and he just immediately turned around, immediately threw a petrol bomb, which immediately hit me and immediately crippled both my arms, I think, and brought me down to like critical health. Like, that was my first encounter in the game, was just sort of standard raider immediately throwing a petrol bomb in my face. And then his dog mauled me to death. And then the next time I managed to pull it off so that I got the jump on him and was able to kill him with a stealth attack and then fight off his dog and then kept roaming in that direction. And the thing I'd forgotten about Fallout was, like I say, I couldn't remember why I liked Fallout 3 so much. I remember that I did. But I couldn't remember how I got over like the bleakness and how depressing the whole place is. And it's mostly because, like, I think to a much bigger extent than any Elder Scrolls game, the landscape's just full of unique things and they're sort of recognizably unique. You know they're unique before you even come across them because you can just see them on the horizon. Like that tower thing is just unlike any other tower in this whole landscape. And there are sort of like some categories of things like radar dishes and stuff, but so much of what you find is just a unique special building. And even amongst the things that do fall into categories, each one is unique. Each one has some weird quirk to it. Like the first I found just a car scrap yard, or just a general scrap yard, I guess. It had a bunch of cars in it and some sort of defunct droids, and there's a little office there, and I broke into that and found a computer and hacked it, and inside it had the option, it had loads of details about shipments of parts for a sentry droid and then controls the sentry droid. And it doesn't, later in the game, you'd usually have access to like the droid's AI. You can tell it whether you want it to be like behave like a security droid or whether you want it to be a firefighting droid and all this other stuff. But this time all I had the choice to do was activate it. And it just said like, no one but RoboCo security personnel should activate the robot. So I did. And I saw it wake up in the junkyard outside, and it's a massive thing. And, it was barking. It's sort of robo speak. That's another thing I forgot about Fallout 3 is it's actually like an amazing retro sci-fi thing. Like, cause it has robots in it. You get all of the kind of Robbie the Robot era sci-fi, and the things they say when they're just idle, hilarious. And kind of give it a particular atmosphere as well. This thing, I was, you know, terrified of everything. And this is a massive robot. It's the, you know, there's like six cars stacked next to it and it's as high as them. And so I didn't go anywhere near it. Didn't even need to try tangling with it to find out whether it was going to kill me or not. It was definitely going to kill me. And then the next raider I found, I disturbed him and, but he hadn't seen me. And so he was roaming around looking for me. And so was his dog. I think I ended up killing his dog because his dog's much better at tracking me than he was, but I didn't kill him. And he eventually wandered all the way to the scrapyard and then saw the robot and was immediately like, ah, I'm going to get you, and ran up to it. And was like ducking behind rocks and trying to take it out. He died. Actually, I killed him because he was so distracted by it that I was able to sneak up to him. And I was desperate to like, I wanted to know how viable a stealth character was. So this was like my opportunity to sneak up on someone who was going to stay where they were. And I managed to take him out that way. So that first experience of like all these things being super dangerous and just being terrified of everything. The first time I went near water, I think I was running away from another raider actually, and I was, you know, afraid for my life. and looting things as I went, and I looted some Myalurk eggs. And it turns out when you open a Myalurk egg, a Myalurk comes out, like a little baby Myalurk. And so I shot at it. And the sound of my shot, all the other eggs in the area burst open with loads of little Myalurks, and they all ran at me. And so I started shooting at them, and then two enormous Myalurks burst out of the water and just completely killed me in two hits. Yeah, then that feeling of like danger and the unknown is so cool. And for that period, I never fast travel, never even thought about it. I didn't even look at my map, really. I just went in the direction that that I could. And like I said, I was sneaking the whole time, so moving at like sort of 60% of your normal movement speed. And it never felt boring. You know, every moment of that was totally gripping. I was just engrossed for like 4 or 5 hours straight. And that stuff's amazing. Now that I'm more into it, there's loads. It's much more, it's a totally different feeling. I do get bored sneaking around, so I, you know, sprint everywhere. I feel way more powerful. I've got amazing guns. I can take on most of the things I find. And just recently, I had a quest that took me from the starting zone to an area that was kind of in the same direction that I first wandered when I left the starting zone. And I was creeping around there. And as you go through the areas you've already explored, some of the stuff is back. Not the same things, but just different things repopulate the landscape. You know, there'll just be different critters and stuff running around. And I was coming up to like a hill, and I saw something big on the horizon. And I was, just from the shape, I sort of thought it was probably a Yao Guai, which is...
Oh, the bear thing.
Yeah, which is big radioactive bears, which are one of the only things I'm still scared of. Those things can still fuck me up. And so I thought, oh, this is great, because I'm miles away. I'm in stealth mode. I'm just going to... I've got... One of the things I've just built is a really good rifle that I think is going to be quite accurate at long range. So I can stay in stealth mode and just shoot him from here. And shot it from there. And as it turned around, I realized that's actually not the shape of a bear. It's much more the shape of a massive, massive military sentry droid. It was the sentry droid that I had first activated all the way back when I started the game. Oh. And this is like 17 hours in. And I think it might even have been on my side when I turned on, because it was sort of... Like I say, I was too scared to check back then, but usually if you activate a sentry droid, it gets to be on your side and it kills things for you. So I might have just pissed off the one thing that that would have been friendly to me. And so I've got this super powerful rifle. It's twice the damage of anything I've ever had before. I'm in sneak mode, and I'm so far away that it never spots me. So I fire at it. It gets this critical sneak attack, 2.5 times damage, and I get 20% extra damage for using rifles. And... I go through about 50 rounds of this, and that's how much it takes to kill it. And when it does blow up, it blows up with the force of a nuke. The explosion just consumes the entire scrapyard. It's a nuclear mushroom. The whole sky goes red. Oh, wow. It's just like everything shakes. And after the explosion clears, the wreckage is on fire, in a way that things are generally not on fire in video games. Like, the flames are just kind of roaring. It's like the size of several cars, and the flame like spans all of that and goes like 50 foot up into the air and is being blown by the wind. It's just this raging inferno.
Oh, wow.
Completely blocking the area. And I walked over the trick because I thought, well, you know, the one bright side of this is maybe it's got some cool stuff to loot. And I'm tentatively going over towards it. I've got my robot butler with me, which is one of the, I think, the first companion you get. And he's a sort of British voiced guy who talks about anything to do with robots, really. And as I came up to it, he said, "Oh, this appears to be a military grade sentry droid, and it appears to be in fully functioning order." As the thing's like raging with fire, and it did have some cool loot. It had some fusion cores, which is great.
Was it not radioactive at all?
No, it didn't seem to be. It did hurt if you went closer to it, I think. But I was able to steal the stuff without any major damage.
Your 10-foot-long arms that you have in RPG, you're close enough to activate the prompts, then you can nick anything you want. Yeah, I think I didn't get that sense of danger from it because I found it so familiar straight off.
Right.
Where it felt so much like a, not just a Bethesda game, but so similar to Fallout 3. In a lot of ways, I went down the story track for a bit thinking I'd get some kind of weapons and grounding first before I actually went off and explored. And, since then, I miss Fallout 3's quirkiness. Like so far after, I don't know, probably about 10 hours, it's nothing, I've never seen anything quite as strange as a little village run by children, or a couple of guys in superhero costumes waging their own personal war one corner of the maps, or anything like Tenpenny Towers, which is a whole, you know, just a fantastic quest line that can go in so many different directions. And none of the quests and none of the people I've met, all the things I've seen, have matched up to any of those spectacles in terms of being interesting or exotic or strange. And I really miss that, because that's the thing I love about Fallout, is the dark sense of humor and the sense of the totally unexpected, that you could just find a crashed UFO with a ray gun in it if you go over this hill. And I don't think I'm ever going to find anything like that in Fallout 4, because I think it's just a much tamer game in many ways in terms of its ambitions, actually. I just think it's quite... I think it's quite unambitious, which sounds strange, but I think compared to the open world games we've seen this year, I think if Fallout 4 had been released this time last year, it would have felt, I would have been much more excited about it. But I think that open worlds have moved on and gotten better and prettier and bigger and more interesting. And
are you comparing this with particularly The Witcher or?
The Witcher, but also MGS5 and just the kind of interactions you're capable of, you know, the systemic interactions that emerge from guard behaviour.
It's interesting. Like, so quest-wise, I haven't found many side quests. In the towns, I get loads of people asking me for their help, but it never sounds that appealing, so I don't do it. And then the main quest I found to be a lot more stylish and more interesting than Fallout 3's. I actually don't know for sure. I'm pretty sure that Nick Valentine is part of the main quest, right?
He is, yeah.
Because I'm working with him on main quest stuff, but the way I came to it was quite incidental and quite natural, and so it almost could have been just like an alternate route or something. But going around with him, he's a great character, and there's a particular... It's just... I got to that just after a bit in a place called Good Neighbor, which has a kind of... pulpy noir hero type subquests that I did there that involved basically taking out gangsters with a special Tommy gun whilst wearing a fedora and a trench coat. And then I met Nick Valentine, who's a PI.
Yeah.
And all of his stuff is PI's themed. And so the whole, like, that whole chapter for like 3 or 4 hours was all kind of noir themed and felt really stylish and cool in the way that certainly Fallout 3's main quest wasn't. But you're right. Now that you mention all those cool things in Fallout 3, I realize I haven't found anything that interesting.
The main quest line in Fallout 4 is the best they've done in terms of main quest lines. It massively outshines, but I don't think it's a very high bar to vault, really, because their quest lines have famously been the thing that you just kind of get through in order to do your adventuring, proper adventuring. And this is the first one where it feels like they've really put loads and loads of effort into doing good story missions. And it's really fun stuff. I'm enjoying it. But I just think that compared to the competition now for this sort of open world RPG, I think it's just kind of, even on its own terms, I don't think it's as exciting as Fallout 3 was, or as interesting a world as Fallout 3 or Skyrim was.
It's interesting, the start of the main quest, or the first few things they tell you to do once you get out into the wilderness, are extremely empowering. And like I say, I went for just 4 hours in my own direction, getting killed by everything and just encountering everything I encountered was a mortal danger. And so I was just totally gripped for the whole time. And then eventually I went back. I kind of wish I'd stuck with this now, but what I wanted to do was just keep doing my own thing forever and never touch the main quest.
Yeah.
But then everyone who's talking about Fallout 4 is talking about like settlements and crafting and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just hadn't been getting access to any of that stuff. And I'm sure it's possible to do it without the main quest, but you're just not told what anything is. Like, I found a workshop, but I just couldn't use it, and there was no explanation as to how I get it to be usable and all that stuff. So little was apparent to me that I thought, you know, this is probably going to be a thing where I just need to do a couple of the main quests just to be introduced to the systems. And then those first couple of main quests, they just throw you straight in at the... It's going to say the deep end, but it's actually more like the shallow end, because they just give you all of the most powerful things in the game immediately. They give you a minigun, a suit of power armor, and they just have you mow down like 50 guys and a death claw. And it's just kind of over at that point. Like, the scariness of the wasteland is over. Now you're just this super powered, awesome person who can take on anything. And so even if you run out of ammo for the minigun and the suit can run out of power cores or whatever, but... you never go back to that feeling of like wonder at the wasteland, of like being terrified of this big scary place, because there was that time when they for free gave you the tools to completely destroy it.
Yeah, I never used the power up after that point, though, because I like my character. I wanted to be able to see her.
Did
you roll a random character, or did you try and make yourself, or what?
I chose Face 01 because I'm playing as a female character, and the Face 01 is just really good. I looked at it. And the customization options, they're not like sliders or choosing from presets. They are a sculpt tool where you like physically drag the clay of the face around to distort it in ways that you like.
And it's pretty amazing.
I'm not going to touch that face for the sculpt tool. There's nothing I can do to that face. Like, I'm not looking at it thinking, oh, its cheekbones are a meter too long. I can push those back in. It's like anything I touch there is immediately going to stand out to me as wrong and mutated. So I just went with the default face. I think I changed her hair, and I've changed her hair like 6 more times since I've been playing, because there's also a hairdresser. You can also actually redo your face with a plastic surgeon. I keep passing him. I haven't done this yet, but I keep passing him in the town, and he always says, you have amazing bone structure. You should come to my plastic surgery. I'm like, well, surely if I'm... doesn't that mean I shouldn't?
Tom?
Yeah, I'm playing as a woman as well. And
the voice acting for the woman is great, I think.
I really like it. Yeah, she's the voice acting across the board is way better. Again, a low bar to vault, but still better in a lot of ways than previous Bethesda games. But I think she's especially good.
Yeah, I really like her.
And I think I chose one of the default faces as well for a similar reason. But because you do your character creation when the world is still pristine and in this kind of beautiful, glowing kind of 50s. Happy Jetsons futurism stuff environment. So I had to deliberately choose a disheveled hairstyle that completely clashed with the entire world at that point, because I knew that the world's going to shit definitely in probably about 25 minutes. I'd pick a disheveled wasteland hairstyle, and it makes it look like you look completely terrible for the first 20 minutes. But as soon as the moment that she walked out of the wasteland, I was like, fucking perfect.
Why are they letting you into the vault?
What's kind of cool is when you get to the hairdresser, you can have a bunch of like more kind of brutish, punky haircuts that you couldn't have in the intro. Like, they don't let you be that outlandish until the world goes to shit. the world's got to shit. I can shave half my hair off now.
Yeah, it's fine. It's acceptable.
But I did a similar thing. I picked the unscrupulous hairstyle initially because I was like,
that's the same one I went for.
All right.
Yeah.
So there are loads that are very perfectly presented. And I thought, this isn't going to make sense in the wasteland. And then what actually happened is I wore the unscrupulous haircut for the intro where I looked disheveled and everyone else looks perfectly neat. And then the apocalypse happens. And then after I get out of the apocalypse, I suddenly start to not like that hairstyle so much. And so I immediately go to the barber and have a really immaculate hairstyle done.
Well, I was walking around the wasteland in a suit, so I didn't. Fuck armor.
I've got so many suits now. I've got massive stat anxiety in Fallout 4, especially because I wish there was a kind of hide helmet option. By stat anxiety, I mean...
Right, yeah.
It's that idea where I want to wear what looks good, but it conveys no stat bonuses, so it needs to be weak in the
world. Don't understand. They've got this amazingly rich crafting system, and they've obviously put loads of effort into redoing how armor works. But the way they've done it doesn't make any sense to me, which is there are now pieces of armor, like torso and arms and legs, individual pieces and helmets. But only like 2 or 3 different outfits can have armor put on them. Everything else, if you put any armor on at all, it removes the outfit. And there's a crafting system to upgrade armor pieces, and you can scrap them into component parts and, you know, combine those with other bits of armor to make them better. But you can't do the thing I want to do, which is take a piece that looks good and then add the armor benefits of the armor pieces. I would like the 2 ways it could work is, one is you get to wear whatever you like, and then you add those armor pieces and they kind of somehow go under the outfit, and then they're just sort of theoretically there and they give you the bonus, which is, you know, a bit of a fudge. Or they could just have it so that here's your outfit. Now, if you want the benefits of this thing, then use the crafting system, combine this with this, and you say, I want, you know, my cool duster coat to look the way it already looks, but I want to add this leather armor piece to it to make it more effective.
Yeah, they've got this undersuit system where you're right, there are only like, I've hardly discovered any undersuits that go under raider armor that you find.
Yeah.
And the main one you have for quite a while is your jumpsuit, which is this ludicrous bright blue thing that looks stupid. So you kind of... is it the good fudge would be that you can apply all armor upgrades to your undersuit and then wear whatever you want over it. So there's a sense that you do have this high-tech armor underneath your rad trench coat, which makes you look like a badass.
I speaking of the voice actor, I love that So you can skip dialogue, which is obviously good, but also that's voice acted too. So when I skip, she, like, someone's in the middle of saying, like, a long speech, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is your backstory, I don't really care. I press A to skip, and my character just goes, dialogue stops, and you get the dialogue options.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool. There's a really good bit of voice acting on her, which I've seen on a YouTube video, where you can find, like, a Mr. Gutsy robot under a bridge in just a random corner of the wasteland, and you can it challenges you, because it's a military mode or whatever, and you can repeat what it says back to it. Over and over and over again, in increasingly silly voices. Self-destructs.
Really?
Takes a loop. Yeah, it's really, really good. So I'll say something like, you know, please deter and return to your homeland. And she goes, please deter and return to your homeland. And that goes on for a while, and then eventually explodes. Pretty good.
She's got a really nice way of, everyone has a name when you hover over them. And seemingly, even if you've never met them before, if you press use on them to talk to them, she will just say their name.
Yeah.
And that is sort of a really, like, direct and disarming way of addressing somebody, particularly if you don't know them, just to say, like, hey, John. And it gives her this strange, like, personality where she's sort of very confident, but also likes to put other people at ease in a way that involves telepathy, because I don't know how she knows these people's names.
But Wasteland McBob, weird-ass name they have.
And I actually, one exception was I talked to a kid in the local newspaper's office, and her name was... I can't remember it. Nat. But when I talked to her, my character said, hey, sweetheart. And so she injects a bit of her personality into it as well.
Hmm. What do you think about the whole base building stuff then? Have you got into that?
I haven't really. I've got two bases, but I didn't go for charisma. And if you don't go for charisma, then you can't make trade routes. And you can eventually upgrade your charisma, but it would be like 6 points I've got to put in there to do that. So that's 6 level ups just devoted to this.
Yeah.
And if you don't have trade routes, then all of your resources have to be at one particular base, or you can split them between them, which would be a terrible thing to do.
Right.
But everything's limited by what resources you have to hand when you're at the crafting station. So you kind of need to put everything in one base. And once you've done that, there's no real reason you'd ever want another base. It's just that place is where you're going to go to craft everything. So that's where you want to be. This might change, but right now I'm not super interested in building buildings. Like I put a bed in my old house and I sleep there. And recently they give you 2 set ones right next to each other, one of which has settlers in it and the other which does nothing. And I've moved into the one that has nothing after trying the one with settlers and just getting fucking irritated. They're all just jerks. They're like the cast of settlers that in that first place is, like 5 assholes who just give you a hard time about everything. Like you just walk near them. They're like, I don't have time to talk to you. I'm busy. And then there's like an old lady who keeps foreseeing your destiny and keeps talking about fate. And I fucking hate
her. Terrible.
I almost never pick the rude option in dialogue, but when you talk to her, the only options to doubt her prophecy foreseeing is to just say, you're lying, old woman, and stuff like that. So I was just brutally rude to her every time she's spoken to me.
I took
and
my revenge by scrapping all the chairs she likes to sit in.
True to video game form, she didn't react in any way to me being incredibly rude to her, and still is very keen to talk to me. And then the only person who's nice to you is just standard video game NPC number one, like the first guy you encounter in every game like this, who's just like, oh, thanks for helping us, and you can join our faction, and you're a hero, and you're great, and we really need your help, and here's how the situation's really bad, and I'm just a straight-laced, straight-talking good guy who's on your side.
So that you get access to 2 settlements very early on, and one of them is that place, which is Sanctuary, which is full of the Minutemen, such as they are. And then there's the small red rocket kind of petrol station, which is a very small area, but it's completely peaceful and none of them ever go there.
Yeah.
So I walked down there and thought...
You built yourself a mansion there where the rest of the
minutes were. Well, it's worse than that because... it began quite innocently because I was just like, well, I wanted to add an extra floor to the gas station. So I built stairs up there and actually built a second wooden of platform on top of it. And I was like, oh, this is cool. I've run out of stuff. But I do know a village up north full of some jerks loads and loads of just crap everywhere. So I went up there and about 10 minutes later, fucking wasteland there. They're just all of their amenities were gone. Whenever I could delete the entire house, I would do it and just absorb it into my person. And, you know, just cars, chairs, water pumps they might need to live, perhaps, I guess. They were all dismantled into their respective components, and then I carried them down south a little bit and got an extra fucking floor on my palace above the Red Rocket. And once I realised that was possible, and there were basically no repercussions whatsoever to completely clearing out any kind of settlements that you found, I would basically make friends with settlements in order to
ravage them.
Ravage them. And so I went out, you go eastwards along the northern line and you come across the Slog, and it's full of these, not mutants, what they call ghouls, who have set up a little farm in an old abandoned swimming pool for kind of swamp gunk that apparently is you can sell. And I looked around, I was like, come on there, bit of steel, few lampposts, more steel fencing, need some steel. Talked to the main guy, and he said, oh, we've got a big super mutant problem, you know, if you could clear those guys out, we'd be really grateful. So I went home and got my power armor and my missile launcher, and then went up to the super mutant base and chunked them all very quickly with some vats and some good missile shooting, and walked back to the guy, and he said, oh man, thank you so much, like, hey, this is your new home. 10 minutes later, just bare. There was no farm there anymore. Like, they're still lingering around there because the AI is just, it isn't going to really understand what you're doing. But I've got a sweet ass doom tower going up over the Red Rocket, petrol station.
My first experience with the settlement stuff was, those settler people I talked about earlier, they kind of lead you to a place and then you settle it together, and, it's where you used to live, so your old house is there. So, but there's no beds at all, I don't think. And so I built a bed in my old house where my bed used to be, and slept there. And then when I woke up the next morning, there was a woman in my bed. And I was just like, I'd had it up to here with these people already. I fucking hated all of them. And now they're sleeping in my bed in my house. And so I took my bladed tire iron.
Oh, God.
And stealth attacked her. And it turns out it was, I can't remember her name now. Someone who's just a jerk to you all the time, which doesn't really narrow it down. She woke up while I was, you know, cutting her head off. And it turns out that I was attacking her, and like, my robot butler was helping by using his flamethrower on her. And then during the fight, I think I was just like, while I was attacking her, the prompt to talk to her came up, and I just pressed it, and I think I must have pressed it several times because we got to the trading screen. So I was able to trade with her while we were fighting, and so trading with like a fellow settler is like with a companion, where you can just take their stuff or give them stuff or make them wear stuff. And so I just, like, all she had was a gun and some ammo, so I just took the gun and took the ammo. And then unfortunately you can't actually kill her. She's just like, all of your settlers are invincible.
Oh really?
And well, I think the unnamed ones probably are killable, but the named ones are all just, they're special story characters, so they can't ever be killed.
Is that true of only the first settlement? Because I think I've seen other settlers die in other settlements.
I think it's just plot characters, like names who have some kind of role to play. But anyway, yeah, she kind of goes into like a crippled state and then gets back up, and then I attacked her again. And then eventually she ran away because she had no weapons. And then I discovered it's because this is the only bed in the settlement, so they're all trying to sleep there, basically. So then I just built them like this kind of ghetto slum where it's just, my bed's the nicest bed you can build, and their beds are just like a shitty, dirty mattress all in the same building, all next to each other. There's just like 8 of them, and just like, whoever needs a fucking bed, just fucking sleep there. Just don't fucking sleep in my fucking house. And then eventually I got so sick of them, I moved out completely and went to Red Rocket, where it wouldn't let me build a bed because you need a person to build a bed. I don't know why, but you can't build a bed unless you have at least one citizen. And then if you have one citizen, they want to sleep in the bed. So
you always have to share your bed.
Seemingly. You? And so I talked to somebody in the main city. And like I say, my lady already knows everybody's name. So she's like, oh, hey, Trevor. And Trevor says, have you got any Nuka-Cola? And I said, yeah, all right, here's a Nuka-Cola. And then he's like, oh, thanks, man, that's so great. And then one of the options is like, do you want to come work for me? And I said that, and it just pops up a message saying like, which settlement do you want to go to? So I sent him to Red Rocket just so I could build a bed there. And
I have a horrible feeling this story won't end very well for Trevor.
It's basically fine for Trevor. He's a disheveled looking guy, and he's got some kind of sort of hippie stereotype going on. Like, he just, once he's there, every time I walk past him, he says, he'll use all my stuff, he'll use my crafting benches, and you can't use them while he's using them. You have to kind of push him out of the way. And every time I walk near him, he says, oh, thanks, man. It's like I could finally think straight. And he just says that every time I pass him. And then eventually I got annoyed with his appearance and forced him to wear a tuxedo at all times to try and neaten up the place. And then it was still annoying that he was there. I built my bed, and then I discovered there is actually an interface. If you're in the workshop interface, you can point at somebody and then tell them to move. And so I've told him to move to Sanctuary now with the other assholes I don't like. And so I'm now truly alone, and I have a bed, and I'm happy.
Yeah, so it sounds like we've managed to have some fun with the settlement stuff, but is it?
I do think it's really good. Not so much the base building stuff, but the weapon crafting thing is really in depth, and it uses components that, like I say, you can either get from scrapping settlements, or you can just get them from, like, all the junk that you could always pick up in Fallout games. Instead of being 90% useless, now it's sort of 90% useful, because it all breaks down into these component parts. If you find duct tape, you can split that. And this, to me, is the most remarkable thing your character can do. You can split duct tape into adhesive and cloth. That is nothing short of a miracle. Like, murdering 60 gangsters, like, there are real people who can do that. Nobody can split adhesive into duct tape into adhesive and cloth. But you can, it's got a really neat system for that, where, like, once you know what you want to build and it's telling you, you can't make this scope for your, or you can't make this loader for your rifle that would increase its rate of fire because you don't have enough oil, you can then mark oil as, like, a thing you're interested in. And then when you're looting a typewriter, a little icon comes up next to it saying, this is one of the things that, this contains something that you need.
I did not know you could do that. That's really useful.
It's really good. Yeah. Almost any time you're crafting anything, if you're lacking ingredients, it says press on the controller, its right button, to mark all the things you don't have as needed.
That's
ingredients.
Really useful.
And so, yeah, that just changes all the looting stuff. Like, you're going through it just junk, and it's just junk, like it was in Fallout 3, except every now and then you're like, oh my god, a telephone. This is amazing. This has got so many springs in it. Or adhesive is the rarest thing, or the most, you, like, almost everything you can make needs adhesive. So you're always running out of it. And so, like, a vial of Wonder Glue is like, oh my god, you've got Wonder Glue? Like, if that's in someone's house, I just steal it. I don't care if they're going to attack me. I need your fucking Wonder Glue. And that that kind of loop of...
I've left so much Wonder Glue in the wild. I was looking at it, why aren't any glue? What the fuck are you glue for?
That loop of, like, the building stuff, running out of these ingredients, marking those ingredients to collect, and then going out in the wilderness and finding them all, is, I found it incredibly compulsive.
Do you find, I hate being over encumbered in games anyway, but in Fallout 4, because it encourages so much kind of stocking up, and like, I can't stand it. I have to wear power armor because it gives you extra strength to carry more shit.
I made my peace with it. I kind of take it as the game telling me, you've had enough, sir. You need to go back to home and, like, take a break. And, cause you can fast travel. I mean, not while you're over encumbered, but if you're getting there, you can fast travel. And then there's just, like, one button to offload all your junk at the workshop. And so these days I don't pick up anything that isn't either junk I need or a weapon I'm actually going to use. Like, I don't really pick up weapons to sell anymore. I sometimes do if they're super valuable, but, like, there isn't much use in having, like, that raider's clothes.
Seems like money is useless.
Yeah, there are, traders do sometimes have legendary weapons.
But they're really expensive. They're like,
yeah, they're like
20,000 or 30,000. And it's like, I'll have that once in this game. And then once I've spent that, I will never have it again.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah.
I wonder if, you probably can't pickpocket them, can you?
Oh.
Cause I think vendor inventories are sometimes sort of just magic in Elder Scrolls games. Sorry, Bethesda games. I know there's several places actually have robot vendors. And, I've got a perk that, it's meant for combat, I think, where if you sneak up close enough to a robot, you can just turn it off. And I can just do that on robot shopkeepers. I can just turn them off and basically just kill them instantly.
That's amazing.
And I did that to this robot shopkeeper, and she had some stuff, like a key to her upstairs chest, and she had some weapons on display that I could steal, but none of her inventory was anywhere to be found.
Hmm. They should adopt a Spelunky style system whereby if you steal from a shopkeeper, they hunt you across the wasteland
all
with a shotgun.
Unionized against you.
Yeah. Shall we do the questions that we take from the questions?
We shall. Yes,
let's do those.
Dave says, "Dear Coffee and Cake, let's talk Metacritic. With the release of Fallout 4, I ended up having a look at the user score for it on there, and at the time of writing this, one day after release, it has a user score of 4.7 with the following breakdown. Positive, 610, mixed, 133, negative, 869. So it appears a lot of people are angry about the game. He goes on for a bit. So his question is, he's heard that some publishers use the score generated on Metacritic as a bar in which they will pay slash not pay staff. And he also wonders if it is based on the user score or the critic score or an average of both. Keep up the top work on the pod, Dave."
I'm pretty sure that it's just the meta score, which that is just the critic score. Like, Metacritic is primarily a thing that averages critics' scores, and the user score is there as a kind of like token thing. I don't think they really rightly prioritize it because as this proves, it's almost always used as a kind of protest thing rather than a kind of actual judgment.
Yeah.
And say what you like about games journalists.
You're still one of us, Tom.
If they're angry at the developer or something, they don't sort of give a punishment score of zero to the game. Like, they actually rate how good it is. And if it has good things about it, it still gets some score. Mm. Whereas I think the user score is often just most of the people rating are the people who are most angry about the game. And then, yeah.
But, it definitely is a thing. I think the way I've heard it works is that there'll be a kind of expected Metacritic score that, and if it passes that, then there might be monetary rewards for it.
There's also, I don't know if, I doubt anyone's basing anyone's pay on it, but there's a thing called OpenCritic now, which is just like Metacritic, but they don't give secret weightings to the scores. Metacritic, you know, give heavier weightings to outlets that they think are important. They also don't guess at a score for reviews that don't give a score, whereas Metacritic do. You know, if you don't give a score, they just try and guess what they think your score was. And also they let critics update their scores if things change. Mm. So basically Metacritic without all the silly rules.
As to the practice of paying people extra based on Metacritic, that definitely does happen. You know, that has happened anyway in the past.
Yeah, sure.
Yep.
Which is ghastly. Really flawed.
Yeah.
Because, there are a lot of problems in Metacritic.
Zach says, "Dear Scroungers, Tom's chat about video game production tax credits was very illuminating. The government of the time justified the policy to the commission based on the idea that the market was failing to produce important culturally British or European games. The government ostensibly sought to incentivize that. Here's some stuff that was eligible according to the test. Hollyoaks, Score, World Goals, Danger Grid, DMC, Definitive Edition, Sunless Sea, Ultratron, Grand Theft Auto 5, Rugby Nations 15. I think that one's kind of acceptable, really. Help the Turtles, Hairy Letters, and Hairy Words 1 and 2, followed by Hairy Phonics 1, 2, and 3. Eye Gaze 1, acclaimed Eye Gaze 1, 2, and 3, I should say. Tony Hawk Shred Sessions, and 4PM. All fantastic representations of British culture, eh? Says somebody, obviously impersonating a Canadian. This is a £120 million programme. So not insignificant, he says. I think if you're subsidising private enterprises with public money, you need to justify exactly why a little better. Your thoughts? Cheers, Zach.
Yeah, it probably isn't the most important problem Britain needs to solve, really.
But if one... this fascinates me, actually. I'm really fascinated by the way, like, the concept of soft power and the ways in which states will provide monetary incentives to create culturally kind of viral things that will go out into other countries and kind of persuade them of that a certain way of life is a good thing. So
just like Hollyoaks.
Just like Hollyoaks is sure to do. But you think of HBO and American drama and the way that has pervaded as society, for example, that American culture feels familiar to us, and that is a form of soft power.
America's very close to winning a culture victory in this game.
Really? Yeah, certainly in our country. And I remember thinking this a lot when Cities Skylines came out, which is made by a European company, but they allow you to build American cities. And for me, that's an example of soft power in action, where the default, like, market acceptance, what the market wants is for people to be able to create an American city that behaves like an American, grid city.
Yeah. I think, like, partly that's probably just because the biggest market is America as well. So, you know.
That's true.
The main place they're going to make their money is going to be people who live in the country that they're simulating.
But if you've got studios in kind of in Europe emulating that to the extent that they're going to base their entire game around it, then that's, you know, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a bit of a weird mishmash, because the thing that sort of did make sense to me was, looking at this, I am being rewarded in large part for using a British artist. If John was not British and I was working with, a non-British artist and a non-British composer, I might not pass this test. And so it's encouraging me to use British talent, which is, a positive thing, I guess. But then actually that's nothing to do with culturally British games. I mean, I suppose you could argue that the British guy is more likely to make a thing that represents Britain in some way. But basically, we just don't fulfill that criteria. We're just not trying to represent Britain. We don't represent Britain. We're just kind of, we're making a game that's set in space. It's about space. We're really as far removed from this world as we can get. But, you can also get points if you are making a game about Britain.
Chloe writes in to say, "Dear Croton Craybar," going for the spoonerism there, "I've recently been playing Undertale, which is an RPG in which killing enemies is up to the player to decide if they want to do or not. The combat system allows you to talk and interact with the monsters during random encounters and boss battles instead of fighting, as well as attempting to spare and refuse to fight altogether. The game's story and tone changes entirely depending on whether the player does this or not." She goes on to say, "After playing a large amount of Undertale and having it bring morality into the normally second nature of kill the enemies because video games, I've noticed myself feeling the same need to spare all creatures in games where being a pacifist will get you killed, like Risk of Rain or Downfall, or Downwell, sorry. Not the
Downfall." Oh my God, someone should do a mashup of Downwell and Downfall.
Oh God. "So my questions are, what other games do you know of, if any, which include player morality in a meaningful way? And has that ever affected your feelings in other games? Regards, Captain Picard's Chloe."
I've had this recently with, not with Undertale, but I've been replaying Deus Ex's 1 and 3. Oh. And replaying 3 first, I haven't finished replaying it, but my playstyle in that, I don't know, maybe something's changed about me since I last played it, but it just seemed natural for me to play in the most stealthy way possible with only non-lethal takedowns. And that, I just sort of fell into that. And once you start doing it, you kind of, any breaking of those rules feels like an error and you need to go back and, load a previous save and try and do it right. And so anything that isn't that feels wrong to me now. And then going from that to Fallout 4, where I'd forgotten, Fallout 3 might have been exactly the same and I just kind of forgot, but the quests are just like, murder 45 people. Like, you just got to go in here and just, like, it'll be like, oh, these raiders are, attacking us. Can you go and sort out their base? And you go to their base. And I was thinking, like, Skyrim bandit caves where there's, like, 5 guys and you just kill them all and you've won. And these are just, like, massive complexes where there's just 7 guys in every room and you just kill and kill and kill and kill and kill for like an hour.
Yeah.
And it suddenly felt really like just depressing to me. I've just gotta, particularly because every kill I do is like a slow-mo headshot that just annihilates the person's skull. It's just an absolute explosion of blood and then a stump and that's it.
Yeah, you'd think the needs of the many would outweigh the needs of the few in this circumstance. They can take a couple of boring settlers tending their cabbage
there
patches.
There were 2 people in the settlement, I'm about to say. They just killed like 45 to save them. And also, like, they're raiders, so their text comes up in red, and that means they're evil. But they...
that's video game morality in one sentence, right?
I mean, they're raiders in the sense that they go around the wasteland and they kill the things they encounter and then steal things from their bodies. That sounds an awful lot like someone else I know in the wasteland. me, that's all I've ever done.
Morality's mostly... like, they had a karma system in Fallout 3, which and in the same way Mass Effect does.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, it's not in Fallout 4. But, the way games do this is to just count your good and bad points, and that's always been done. Like, I love Mass Effect 3 because, like, Mass Effect has always pursued a kind of morality point system, which, but the best parts, Morrie were the actual decisions you made in the final parts of each of this three game quest arcs, like the Krogue and Jenna page.
Oh yeah.
Dilemma is incredible. And that's just it's a dilemma of context and consequence. And it's nothing to do with point systems. And, maybe Morgan should pursue that.
Yeah. It's probably one of the hardest decisions I think I've made in the game.
That was a three cup of tea problem.
Yeah. Jamie Morrison says, "Dear Crazy Cowbell, listening to episode 111 the other day, and whilst Graham was talking about how much he spends on FIFA, Rich chimed in with a story about a guy he knew whose son was addicted to FIFA to the extent that he was emailing EA customer support claiming he'd been hacked. And this really hit home with a situation my family are dealing with just now." And he goes on to explain a situation involving his 12-year-old brother. And it turns out, between the 28th of September and 20th of October, my brother made around 32 transactions, totaling around £430.
Whoa.
It would have been more had there been money, as there were a number of failed transactions too. Oh, the majority of it was on FIFA points, although there were a few special crates for Call of Duty and some Forza tokens. He goes on to say, "Now this is a fairly average kid, a little spoilt maybe, but never outright bad, misbehaved or malicious. I also work with a woman whose 17-year-old son did pretty much the same thing. His dad's card was registered to his account. In the space of a month, he spent almost the same amount. Actual games this time." And he goes on to say, "My question is, there seems to be an increase in the amount of games that have an element of this, buying points or tokens with real money in order to achieve some minor in-game benefits. So how does the average consumer combat this? Other than just being smarter in what we purchase, do you think there is anything we can do about these increasingly dirty business practices, or should we just expect to have systems like this eventually in every game? Thank you for your time to read this lengthy tale," which I didn't because I synopsized it. Sorry. "I've only just discovered this podcast. I am loving it, making my way through the episodes in reverse. Sincerely, Jamie Morrison."
That's a shocker.
Yeah, £430 is quite a lot of money to spend on not something that isn't real.
Yeah. I think kids don't understand money yet.
Yeah.
You have to be super careful about that.
Yeah.
I mean, so the two examples he gave is one was microtransactions. The other one he said was actual games, right? The other person was his friend, son was actually purchasing games. So that's...
I don't know how you can stop that. I mean, yeah. You can stop that by not giving them a card. I think the in-game purchases thing is far more insidious. And I actually think games should be brought more heavily under the legislation we have for gambling in this country, and probably also regulated in other ways in terms of the way that they're age-gated. Yeah. I would quite happily see age restrictions based on the kinds of transactions that are in games.
Yeah.
I'd also be good to see games where there were parental controls about the type of transactions that were visibly available to... So if you bought a game for your kid and had microtransactions and you're a parent buying it for your child, you should have the option to hide all of those, that advertising and all of the hooks that might lead the child to buy stuff. Mm. That should be a parental control option.
That certainly won't happen without actual laws requiring it.
No, yeah, of course not. It's definitely not. But, you know, he's identified a serious problem there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the way that games use compulsion to hook people in it's a science that has developed very rapidly over the last few years, and I don't think legislation has caught up with it. Or even, I imagine most of the people involved in lawmaking are even aware of this as a problem. But it really is a problem. I think it is as toxic as gambling addiction, certainly.
Do you remember when you used to run up massive bills because the phone and internet costs things per hour? Both all of the time you're online was a phone call, and in the UK that wasn't free, which is a big difference between the UK and the US when the internet was in its infancy, because local calls in the US are free and they're not here in the UK. And then also you're paying the ISP. How was it billed? Because it was per hour, I think, wasn't it?
Usage. Well, by per minute. I don't know. I can't remember.
Yeah, so you could run up absurd bills by using the internet. That was addictive. I don't know if you've known this. The internet is quite addictive.
Yeah, I think I did get in trouble for that once. Although that was at the same time that, regularly, it was even a cultural accepted phenomenon that people get in trouble for phoning their girlfriends or boyfriends for prolonged periods of time and racking up huge bills.
Did that too.
We got a lot of questions this week, and a lot of them were really, really good. So we're just not going to read some of them. Sorry. But maybe if nobody sends us a question next week, we'll get around to some of the good ones that missed out on this.
Yeah, podcast. If you guys could try and be especially shit next week.
They never are, though. Charlie says, hello, Cretians and Crow Barbarians. 'Twas listening to your fine podcast as I laid my head down to rest. Then Charlie goes on to say a whole bunch of other stuff leading up to the question. Many of my dreams have faded into the void of oblivion, but I ask you whether you have dreamed of any games that you have played or whether you had any control within them.
To which I would say yes, and that games have been responsible for the most boring dreams I've ever had in memory. Of all the dreams I can remember, there was one. Being stuck in vents is a thing that has transferred into my dreams from Deus Ex and every other game that uses vents, which is all games. So I remember, like, the worst dream I ever had was infiltrating a police station and being stuck in a vent above, like, a grate, and below there were two police officers talking about donuts for eternity. And I was stuck there, and the entire dream was just the feeling of being, it was an anxiety dream about being trapped while these people talked about donuts and nothing forever. And that's why I hate video games now.
The thrust of Charlie's question is actually that playing video games makes you more able to dream lucidly. I have control of the dream while you're in it. Recognize that it is a dream and then control it.
I've certainly not experienced that.
I think I might have had that, like, once, and a kind of, not to do with video games, but just, you know, realizing you're dreaming and then realizing, oh, this is, you know, it gives you a kind of power over the dream to some extent.
Yeah. I think if you watch the film, This Waking Life is all about lucid dreaming. Yeah. And that made me really want to experience it. And try as I might, never had. Paul Scorthorne says, or tweets, does the world really need more Assassin's Creed style games?
To which I would say yes, because Assassin's Creed desperately needs a competitor to actually kick its ass a bit, force it to raise its game. And there's always a chance that, for example, a lot of people are saying that EA are making a competitor, and it might just be better. And I would like to play a better version of Assassin's Creed. So, you know, that's cool.
You know, I don't have any hatred of Assassin's Creed as a series. I think that its problem is that it's always trying to improve itself, or rather differentiate a sequel from its previous one by adding more stuff. And I fundamentally think they need to be overhauling the core fantasy that game purports to present, and not just adding extra mini games on top of it. They need to be making the process of assassination and parkour and all those systems way, way more convincing and better and fluid.
They're really out of date now. It feels out of date when you play it, and it's still a great idea. I think the core fantasy of being a free running assassin is amazing in open world titties derived from history. That's a fantastic thing to make games about. But they've committed themselves to an annual production cycle that will never allow them to fix or advance it sufficiently, I think.
I also wonder if there's something in, like, when you're building a franchise, like, it's obviously, I think Ubisoft must just love it. It must just be, you know, perfect for them, because it just comes out every year and it just does a stable amount of business. And the new one did suffer in its first week sales because of the old one being so broken on launch. Lots of people stayed off it from launch, but then it caught up again in the next week because it got good reviews. But in terms of, like, if you're building a franchise from a business perspective, the idea of taking anything away from that franchise is sort of poison. You know, like, the fans want everything they got last time plus whatever your new features are. And if you're for a designer to come and say, like, oh, we think for the good of the game, we actually need to take some of this stuff out and redo it and change the way it works without adding anything new, that would just be like, what?
Yeah. Marketing only understands bullet points, doesn't it?
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Benjamin Rose says, what was your favourite open world this year? Not the game, the world itself.
It's an interesting one because, for example, the game of Metal Gear Solid 5 is great and better than The Witcher 3, but the world of The Witcher 3 is will stay with me for a long time, I think, especially the Skelliger Isle. So, I think that's an astonishing, detailed, bustling.
I don't know if he, does he mean like the fictional structure of the world, or does he mean specifically the landscape?
I assume the game world.
The world itself, I think. Yeah. And all that contains, so I suppose, like the way it looks and how original it is.
I've really come to love the landscapes of Afghanistan and Zaire-Angola border region in Metal Gear Solid. I didn't find them particularly beautiful at first. I found Afghanistan to be quite desolate and Angola / Zaire to be just kind of a mulch. But the more time I spent in those games, the more kind of alluring they became, strangely. I don't know exactly what it was.
I have a really quick question to ask about those two. Have you found any cracks in Zaire? So in Afghanistan, there's the, like in cliffs, there's things called cracks which you can climb, and they let you get to cool sniper spots and infiltrate by alternate means. I haven't found a single one anywhere in Zaire, even though there are like really long cliff ridges the way you can get up to the top, but there's, you know, the top is navigable space. But there's just no way to get up the cliff face. And in Afghanistan, they seem really consistent. I've never found one in the other place.
I never came across a single crack in the entire game so far.
It feels as if like there were the idea of those, the sort of the design doc bullet point was only given to half the team. The team who were making the other one never heard about like, what, there's a what feature? You can do what?
Yeah, quite possibly. I don't know.
I think my answer to this question might be Fallout 4.
Yeah.
Because Metal Gear... I love it, but I love it almost all because of the systems and the stealth and the how that all ties together. The Witcher 3, I didn't get that far in, really. I found it pretty, but the bits I played were very standard fantasy landscape. Dragon Age, I really liked the fantasy of that game, like the fiction of it, but actually the individual places I went to did feel like zones, like an MMO, where this one is this themed, and then when you get to the edge of it, it's...
They did feel very remote-like, actually.
Whereas Fallout 4 is the only one where, like, I'll happily just point myself in a direction and just walk and just see what I find, and I'm excited to do that.
It's a hard question, though. It's been an absurd year, hasn't it, for open world?
Yeah. Is Just Cause going to be this year?
Yeah.
It's next week, isn't it?
Yeah.
That'll be the best.
Will it, though? Do we have time for two more questions?
I think we do.
One's really brief.
They're little ones.
Nick talks about life is strange and crying at it, and he says that he finds that games affect him much more than movies or books do. So do you cry at games ever? And do you find it much more kind of easily... do you find yourself, rather, more easily manipulated into a good blub by video games?
Not in my experience, personally, but I don't really cry at things.
I find it much less with games than with films. Yeah. Films are much more effective at needling my sensitive spots, partly because does he say that it was something to do with like the music kicking in at the right time and stuff? So that does get me when it's done effectively. And in games, it's harder to do it effectively because you don't control everything about the moment. You don't know. I mean, in some games you do, but most of the games I play are very freeform and open, and so they have no idea what I'm doing, really. And it's very difficult to get the music to have just the mood that the player is feeling, and also the player's level of engagement is kind of a variable as well. Whereas with a movie, if you're still watching after like an hour, you're probably really into it, and you probably care about what's happening to the characters and stuff. And so it's like embarrassingly common, really, for the end of a movie to slightly get my tear ducts watering a little bit.
It's interesting. I mean, he brings up the idea that agency will presumably involve you more in the fiction and thus connect you more with it, make you more emotional about it. But I actually find agency probably detracts from not my emotional connection to it, but the extent to which I'm going to be compelled to tears, because I feel like I need to do stuff, you know, like I need to be in control here. You know, whereas in a film I'm just passively observing this stuff and, you know,
I think that's
weeping
just,
like a baby.
There's a part of my brain that if I'm going to need to act, that part of my brain is just a kind of like cunning, conniving engine of calculation that just like takes some input and then just like, how can I exploit this? How can I make this benefit me? And so all the time I'm playing a game, that is running. I'm always thinking, like, even in the most emotional cutscene or whatever, I'm always thinking, yeah, but when do I get control? Does that when I got injured in that cutscene, is that going to affect my actual character? Because I don't want that to affect my character. I want to be in the best possible state. And so, yeah, that while that thing is running, I'm never going to cry. That thing's a jerk.
I have sniffled at games before, but I can't remember what they are now offhand. I think Life is Strange did affect me emotionally, actually, in lots of places. But I think the emotions that were more successful are moments where nice things happened. I'm like, oh, that's so beautiful. Because that's a much more kind of easy, positive reaction. Whereas if something is negative, then, like you say, I'm thinking about how that's going to impact me and thinking about, oh, I must have failed at something. And it makes me annoyed. Like, I feel like I'm responsible for it. So I often feel cheated because obviously these things are often foisted upon you. And if there's any kind of artificiality to the tragedy that's occurred, I'm just like, oh, fuck off. You know?
Yeah.
Whereas in a film, obviously you completely resign all control to it. So you're not responsible for it and you can't feel any kind of sense of guilt or irritation.
I think that games are so bad at faces.
There is that.
The basic kind of tools of human empathy, the things that you can latch onto, that actually it's very, very hard, unless you have a huge amount of kind of story context around the character, to actually feel anything about them. And I'd return again to the Gen of Age resolution of Mass Effect 3 as a thing that I almost got weepy over. And in fact, with Garrus as well in that game. And that's because I had like 100 hours of being with those people and with those characters and with this, like, BioWare's incredibly consistent writing of characters across this entire trilogy that really sold them to me when it came to the crunch, man, I felt that.
I wonder if the Genophage thing, if they were able to kind of adjust course on that, because it came up, was it in all three games?
It was always there from the beginning, yeah.
So if they saw people going in one direction, like if 90% of people all were against it in the first game, they could actually adjust the fiction and say, have you thought about this and this?
I would not be surprised at all.
And the final question from Jonathan Fitt, which we may not answer adequately, but is a good question. Hello, Detective Crates and the sultry crowbar that done him wrong. I was interested in your description of Vermintide, reminding you of that scene from the opening of Age of Ultron. It reminded me of the way that the Matrix lobby scene became an inspiration for parts of several games and a host of mods. Max Payne, Fear, and Action Half-Life spring to mind. There are others, I'm certain. It was a real-world setting with tons of baddies, pillars that get wrecked, and bullets everywhere. The protagonists leap around, balletically shooting and biffing everyone, without so much as a raised eyebrow. Cool as cucumbers. It wasn't just about the bullet time, which obviously became a cliché. The Matrix redefined what a super cool action sequence looked like for a generation of games and other films. So my question is, what other scenes from films do you see having inspired games? Have you seen anything recently that you're pretty sure will be inspiring games in the future? All the best, Jonathan Fitt.
It's a really good question.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are some side-scrolling fighting games based on the Old Boy sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Or was that derived from
possibly,
old school kind of Double Dragon?
It could also go both ways. I mean, probably the Matrix scene was inspired by some video game stuff.
The Matrix is a fantastic example. I think that is actually a landmark film in many ways. I love that it's just 90 minutes and so lean and such a great action movie. And
I mean, 3D Realms love The Matrix so much that they trademarked the word bullet time.
There you go. I would say in terms of things that many games have stolen from, there are like Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan. Inspired dozens of the big World War II gluts. So much of that was just were set pieces stolen almost one-to-one.
The first Call of Duty game matches the set pieces of that series one-to-one. In fact, Philip War, otherwise known as Pip War, which is what I was going to say first, is doing a playthrough of the Call of Duty series at the moment.
It's great.
It's actually how much of those games and the quality of them that I'd forgotten.
They've
been obscured by later Call of Duty nonsense.
I remember playing those a couple of years ago again, and they're legitimately like some of those mini campaigns they did. And the way they tried to show, like, it's so difficult to tackle Second World War anyway, but they had these separate campaigns from separate perspectives, trying to show different fronts, and even just trying to show just a pluralistic view of the war. It's just so much. It kind of diffuses so much of the problematic nature of the later campaign.
Come on, be fair. You did get to briefly play as part of a terrorist unit in Modern Warfare to mow down civilians.
That is
so
true.
Plural. That totally gave you both sides of the story.
Plural as fuck.
I tell you what. This is going to be a spoiler for Black Ops 3, so please skip ahead 30 seconds. Do you guys mind
if I spoil this? I could not give a shit.
It turns out in Black Ops 3, well, it's heavily implied in Black Ops 3 that all previous Call of Duty games are in fact the hallucinatory flicker of a dying cyborg's mind.
Oh my gosh. Holy shit, really?
Yeah, you go into the mind of a dying cyborg and she hallucinates all these previous World War II sequences and stuff. And it's like, hang on, I remember playing. Didn't I play that in?
Oh my god.
So yeah.
That's really weird.
I think it's kind of cool, actually. But, like, it, you know. Yeah.
So yeah. No Russian was fine.
Yeah, but in terms of other films, I mean, we were saying, I it's so annoying, this question, because I know I've come out of the cinema recently and gone, that is a film that's going to get ripped off by games when they come out in 4 years' time. Yes. I can't remember what any of them are, annoyingly. But obviously Mad Max, I guess.
Yeah, Fury Road is definitely going to spoil a lot. The bit where, like, if Uncharted 5 or 6 doesn't do a scene where you're on a convoy and there are motorbikes on ramps flying over you and you're shooting them off, then I will be incredibly surprised.
I hope there's a bit where Tom Hardy comes up and you can use him as an armrest to like level your sniper rifle.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, he'll be sent out as a peripheral by, for VR.
No, I feel like we should return to that question at some point. Like, we'll definitely forget and never will, but we really should, because there are so many films that you could absolutely see game designers looking at and going, yeah.
Next time you see a film like that, you'll come out thinking, I'm sure there's a question about this in some context. Someone wanted to know this, but we can't remember who.
Yeah.
But those are all the questions that we have time for this week.
Very well. I've been listening to the audiobook of Lustrum by Robert Harris, which is a thing about Cicero and Roman times, and his voice for the reader's voice for Cicero reading out a speech is that, very well, and we shall proceed. You wish to send us questions, you may do so at questions@quaintandcrowbar.com. You may also post them on the forum, as the Romans did. Quaintandcrowbar.com/forum.
Kind of appropriate, really.
You can tweet them at us, at quaintandcrowbar on Twitter. And is that it for question submission methods?
Yeah, probably.
And you can back us on Patreon, patreon.com/quaintandcrowbar.
Join us on the Discord channel for chat, hot chat as well, which you can find the link for from our homepage.
And you can follow us on Twitter individually. I am at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm at PCGLudo, and that's LUDO.
I'm at Marsh Davis, DAVIES.
That's well,
everybody.
Listening,
everybody. Everybody.
I should have said, thank you for listening, everybody!